and never needed brushing. Why, I... She shrieked and shot up into the air, hovering a foot above the nightstand. A wash of cold went over Lucy. She pulled the blankets up around her, looking about the room anxiously.
Jessie?
He materialized at the foot of the bed, in the same black trousers and shirt sleeves he always wore. His eyes were green and very serious. I am here. Lucy looked up at Jessamine.
Could I have a moment to speak with Jessie alone? Alone?
Jessamine looked horrified.
But he's a gentleman. In your bedroom.
I am a ghost, said Jessie dryly. What is it exactly you imagine I might do?
Please, Jessamine, said Lucy.
Jessamine sniffed.
Never in my day,
she announced, and vanished in a swirl of petticoats.
Why are you here?
Lucy said, hugging the blankets to her chest. It was true that Jessie was a ghost, but she still felt awkward about the idea of him seeing her in her nightgown.
I don't remember you leaving, at the bridge.
Your brother and friends seem to have the situation well in hand, Jessie said. His gold locket glimmered at his throat. And your brother can see ghosts. He's never seen me before, but...
Huh,
Lucy said.
You do realize I just had to be dishonest with my family and pretend as if I didn't know you existed, or that you raised the dead to bring Cordelia out of the river.
What?
I mean, I'm grateful that you did. Brought Cordelia out of the river, I mean. Don't think I'm not. It's just...
You think I called the dead out of the river? Jessie demanded. I answered the call. Despite the blanket, Lucy suddenly felt cold all over.
What do you mean?
You called the dead, said Jessie. You called the dead, and the dead came. I heard you, across the whole city, calling for someone to help you.
What do you mean? Why would I have any ability to call the dead up? I can see them, but I certainly can't command.
She broke off. She was suddenly back in Emmanuel Garst's bedroom in that small, terrible flat. You will, she had said when the ghost proclaimed he would never tell, and he had given up his secrets. Leave us, she had said, and he had winked out of existence. You were the only one who could see me in the ballroom, said Jessie. You have always been the only one who could see me besides my family. There's something unusual about you. She stared at him. What if she ordered Jessie to do something? Would he have to do it? Would he have come to her if she called, as he had on the riverbank? She swallowed.
When we were beside the river, when you were with me, you were holding that locket at your throat, clutching it.
And you want me to tell you why, he said, and she knew he'd had the same thought she had. She didn't like the thought. She didn't want to order him around, or Jessamine. Perhaps she had to be panicked, though, she told herself. She'd been frightened in Garst's flat, and again at the river.
If you want to, she said.
This locket was placed around my throat by my mother, he said. It contains my last breath.
Your last breath?
I ought to tell you how I died, I suppose, he said, perching himself on the windowsill. He seemed to like it there, Lucy thought, just on the threshold. I was a sickly child. My mother told the Silent Brothers that I wasn't well enough to withstand being given runes, but I begged and begged. She managed to fight me off until I was 17. You might understand that by then I was desperate to be a shadow hunter, like other shadow hunters. I told her that if she did not let me get the marks, I would run away to Alicante and get them myself.
And did you? Run away?
He shook his head. My mother relented, and the Silent Brothers came to the manor house. The rune ceremony went off without a hitch, and I thought I had triumphed. He held up his right hand, and she realized what she had thought was a scar was the faint outline of the Voyance rune. My first rune, and my last.
What happened?
When I returned to my room, I collapsed on my bed. Then I woke in the night, burning with fever. I remember screaming and Grace running into my room. She was half hysterical. Blood was welling from my skin, turning the sheets to scarlet. I writhed and screamed and tore at the bedspread, but I was weakening, nor could they use healing runes on me. I remember realizing I was dying. I had become so weak. Grace held me as I shivered. She was barefoot, and her nightgown and wrapper were soaked with my blood. I remember my mother coming in. She held the locket to my lips, as if she meant me to kiss it.
"Did you?" Lucy whispered.
"No," said Jessie, matter-of-factly. "I died." For the first time in her life, Lucy felt a pang of pity for Grace. To have her brother die in her arms like that, she could not imagine the agony. "I came slowly to understand I was a ghost after that," said Jessie, "and it took me months of trying before my mother and sister could hear me and speak to me. Even then, I disappeared every morning when the sun came up, and only came back to consciousness with evening. I spent many nights walking alone in Brosland Forest, with only the dead to see me. And you, a little girl who'd fallen into a fairy trap." Lucy blushed. "I was surprised when you saw me," he said. "And even more when I was able to touch your hand and lift you out of that pit. I thought perhaps it was because you were so young, but no. There is something unusual about you, Lucy. You have a power that is tied to the dead." Lucy sighed. "If only I could have a power that was tied to bread and butter pudding." "That would not have helped Cordelia last night," Jessie said. He let his head fall back against the window pane, and Lucy saw that, of course, he was not reflected in the dark glass. "My mother believes that once everything is in order, and she has all the ingredients a warlock will need, the last breath in this locket can be used to resurrect me. But on the riverbank, I was holding it because..." Lucy raised her eyebrows. "I thought at first you might have been in the water, drowning. The life force in the locket could have emptied your lungs and let you breathe." He hesitated. "I thought, if you were dying, I would use it to bring you back." Lucy inhaled sharply.
"You would do that? For me?"
His eyes were fathomless deep green, the way Lucy imagined the depth of the ocean. His lips parted as if he meant to answer, just as a shaft of dawn light pierced the window glass. He stiffened, his eyes still locked on hers, as if he had been shot through with an arrow.
"Jessie," she whispered, but he had already vanished.
Days passed. London, Grosvenor Square, 1901. On the night of the death of Queen Victoria, the bells of London erupted into clamorous alarm. Matthew Fairchild also grieved, but not for a dead queen. He grieved for the loss of someone he had never known, for a life that had ended, for a future whose happiness would always be tainted with the shadow of what he had done. He knelt before the statue of Jonathan Shadowhunter in his family's parlour, his hands covered in ash. "Bless me," he said haltingly, "for I have sinned. I have..." He stopped, unable to say the words. "Tonight, someone died because of me, because of my actions. Someone I loved, someone I didn't know, but I loved them just the same." He had thought the prayer might help. It did not. He had shared his secret with Jonathan Shadowhunter, but he would never share it with anyone else, not his parabatai, not his parents, not a single friend or stranger. From that night on, an impassable chasm opened between Matthew and the whole world. None of them knew it, but he was cut off from them forever, in all the ways that mattered. But that was as it should be, Matthew thought. After all, he had committed murder. 18. Darkness stirs. The dead are sleeping in their sepulchres, and, mouldering as they sleep, a thrilling sound, half sense, half thought among the darkness stirs, breathed from their wormy beds all living things around, and, mingling with the still night and mute sky, its awful hush is felt inaudibly. Percy Bysshe Shelley, A Summer Evening Churchyard, Lechlade, Gloucestershire. It was late afternoon by the time James was able to pry himself away from the Institute. It seemed every Enclave member who passed through the gates wanted to interrogate him about Mandacore demons and head to Grosvenor Square to meet the rest of the Merry Thieves. After letting himself into Matthew's house with his key, James paused for a moment on the steps that led to the cellar. He knew his friends were in the laboratory. He could hear their voices rising up toward him like smoke, could hear Christopher chattering, Matthew's low and musical tones. He could feel Matthew's presence, this close to his parabatai, like one magnet coming within range of another. He found his friends seated around a high marble-topped laboratory table. Everywhere were instruments of curious design, a galvanometer for measuring electrical currents, a torsion balance machine, and a clockwork orrery of gold, bronze, and silver, a gift from Charlotte to Henry some years ago. A dozen different microscopes, astrolabes, retorts, and measuring devices were scattered across the table and cabinet tops. On a plinth rested the Colt single-action army revolver Christopher and Henry had been working on for months before all this had happened. Its river-grey nickel plating was deeply engraved with runes and a curving inscription, Luke 12:49. Christopher's brass goggles were pushed up into his hair. He wore a shirt and trousers that had been burned and stained so many times he had been forbidden to wear them outside. Matthew could have been his mirror opposite. In blue and gold waistcoat and matching spats, he stood well away from the flames of the Bunsen burners, which had been turned up so high that the room was the temperature of a tropical island. Oscar napped gently at his feet. "What's going on, Kit?" said James, testing to see the temperature at which shadow hunters melt. "My hair is certainly ruined," said Matthew, pushing his hands through the sweat-darkened strands. "I believe Christopher is hard at work on the antidote. I am assisting by providing witty observations and trenchant commentary." "I'd rather you handed me that beaker," said Christopher, pointing. Matthew shook his head. James grabbed the beaker and passed it to Christopher, who added a few drops of its contents to the liquid simmering in a retort by his elbow. He frowned. "It's not going well, I'm afraid. Without this one ingredient, it doesn't seem likely to work." "What ingredient?" James asked. "Malus root, a rare plant. Shadow hunters aren't supposed to cultivate it because doing so violates the accords. I have been searching, and I asked Anna to try to get me some in Downworld, but we've had no luck." "Why would anyone be forbidden from growing some silly plant?" said Matthew. "This plant only grows in soil that has been soaked by the blood of murdered mundanes," said Christopher. "I stand corrected," Matthew admitted. "Ugh. Dark magic plants, is it?" James's eyes narrowed. "Christopher, can you draw me a sketch of the root?" "Certainly," said Christopher, as if this were not at all an odd request. He took a notebook from the inside pocket of his jacket and began to scribble on the back. The liquid in the retort had begun to turn black. James eyed it warily. "There were some forbidden plants growing in Tatiana's greenhouse," James explained. "I told Charles about it at the time, and he didn't seem to feel they were of any great concern, but..." Christopher held up the sketch of an almost tulip-like plant with sharp-edged white leaves and a black root. "Yes," James said, his excitement rising. "I remember those. They were in the greenhouse at Chiswick. They struck me because those leaves looked like knives. We could go there now. Is there a carriage free? Yes. Matthew's excitement matched James's own. Charles had some sort of meeting, but he left the second carriage in the mews. Put your goggles down, Christopher. Time for some field work. Christopher grumbled slightly. All right, but I have to go change. I'm not allowed out in these clothes. Just switch off anything that might burn down the house first, said Matthew, catching hold of James's arm. We'll meet you in the front garden. James and Matthew fled through the house, pursued by Oscar, barking in excitement, then paused a moment on the front steps, breathing in the cool air. The sky was heavy with clouds. A bit of weak sunlight peeked through, illuminating the path from the Fairchilds' front steps to the wall of the front garden and the gate that led to the street. It had been raining earlier, and the stone was still wet. "Where's Thomas?" James asked, as Matthew tipped his face back to look up at the clouds. Though they did not look rain-heavy, they had an energy to them as of an oncoming electrical storm. As did Matthew, James thought. "Patrolling with Anna," said Matthew. "Remember, Thomas is the most elderly of our group. He is required for day patrol." "I am not sure just 18 is precisely elderly," said James. "He should have some years before senility sets in." "I get the sense sometimes that he rather likes Alistair Carstairs, which would indicate senility has already set in." "I am not sure he likes him precisely," said James, "but rather feels as if he ought to be given a second chance after his behaviour at school." James paused, thinking of Alistair's strained face and panicked eyes in the library at Cornwall Gardens. "And perhaps he is right. Perhaps we all deserve one." "There are some people who do not deserve one." Matthew's voice was fierce. "If I ever catch you considering befriending Alistair, James..." "Then what?" James said, arching an eyebrow. "Then I will have to tell you what Alistair said to me the day we left the academy," said Matthew, "and I would rather not. Cordelia should never know it, if nothing else. She loves him, and she should be allowed that." Cordelia. There was something about the way Matthew said her name. James turned to him, puzzled. He wanted to say that if Alistair had truly said something so awful it would threaten Cordelia's affection for him, Matthew should not suffer it in silence. But there was no chance. Christopher had burst out the front door, pulling on gloves. He wore a hat, tilted sideways on his head, and a green scarf that matched none of his other clothes. "Where's the carriage?" he asked, descending the steps. "We were waiting for you, Christopher, not fetching you a carriage," said James, as the three of them crossed the front garden to the mews, where a large carriage house held the consul's horses and means of transportation. "Besides, I'm fairly sure Darwin said something about it being healthful for scientists to walk." Christopher looked indignant. "He certainly didn't." The front gate rattled. James turned to see shadows perched atop it. No, not shadows. Demons, ragged and black. They leaped soundlessly to the ground, one after another, stalking toward the shadow hunters. "Cora demons," James whispered. Matthew already had a short sword out, and Christopher a seraph blade. It crackled as he named it, like a broken radiometer. James whipped a throwing knife from his belt, turning to realize that they had been cut off from retreating to the house. The demons were circling them, as they had tried to circle Christopher on the bridge. "I don't like this," said Matthew. His eyes were burning, his teeth bared. "At all." The hat had fallen from Christopher's head. It lay sodden on the damp, stony ground. He kicked at it in frustration. "James, what next?" James heard Cordelia's voice in his head, gentle and certain. "You are the leader." "We cut through the circle of demons there," he pointed, talking fast, "and duck into the carriage house. Lock the doors behind us with a rune." Brings new meaning to the saying, don't frighten the horses, Matthew muttered. All right, let's go.
They spun toward the area James had indicated, knives flying from James's hands like arrows from a bow. Each met its target, sinking deep into demon flesh. The Cora demons skittered away, howling, and the boys bolted through the gap between them toward the mews, just as the sky crackled with thunder. They sprang through white tendrils of fog. James reached the gate to the mews first and kicked it open, then nearly doubled over, pain shooting through him. He turned to see that a Cora had seized hold of Matthew and thrown him. Christopher was battling another of the shadowy creatures, his seraph blade describing a sputtering arc of light as he slashed at it. James choked. Matthew must have had the breath knocked out of him, and turned to race toward his parabatai as the Cora reared up over Matthew's body. A flash of gold sprang between Matthew and the shadow, sending the Cora reeling back. It was Oscar. The retriever sailed past the demon, missing a savage blow from its claws by barely an inch, and landed near Matthew. The Cora started back toward the boy and the dog. Matthew threw his arms around Oscar, the puppy James had saved and given to him so long ago, curving his body to protect his dog. James spun, a knife in each hand, and let them fly. The knives sank to their hilts in the demon's skull. It blew apart. One of the other demons screamed, and Matthew leaped to his feet, seizing up his fallen sword. James could hear him shouting at Oscar to go back into the house, but Oscar clearly felt he had scored a great victory and had no intention of listening. He growled as Christopher paused at the mews gate, shouting for the others to follow him. James turned. Christopher! It rose up behind Christopher. A massive shadow, the biggest Cora demon James had seen yet. Christopher started to turn, raising his seraph blade, but it was too late. The Cora had reached around Christopher, almost as if it meant to embrace him, pulling his body back toward it. His weapon went flying. Matthew started to run toward Christopher, skidding across the wet ground. James couldn't move. He was out of knives. He grabbed for the seraph blade in his belt, but there was no time. The demon's great clawed hand raked across Christopher's chest. Christopher screamed, and the Cora demon shoved him away. He crumpled to the ground.
No!
James broke into a run, zigzagging toward Christopher's fallen body. Something lunged toward him. He heard Matthew shout, and a shalikar sliced an oncoming Cora in half. James jerked his seraph blade free, heading for the demon that had wounded Kit. It turned to look at him. Its eyes were knowing, almost amused. It bared its teeth and vanished, just as the Cora demons in the park had.
Jamie, they've gone, Matthew called. They've all gone.
The front gates burst open with a ringing clang of metal and a carriage rolled into the front garden. The doors flew open, disgorging Charles Fairchild. James dimly realised that Alistair Carstairs was also there, looking around himself with a stunned expression. As James dropped to his knees by Christopher, he could hear Charles demanding to know what was going on. Matthew shouted back, asking if Charles was blind. Couldn't he see Christopher was hurt and needed to go to the Silent City? Charles kept demanding what had happened to the demons, where they had gone. He'd seen one when they'd first crashed through the gates, but where were they now?
I will take him, Alistair was saying. I will take him to the Silent City.
But the words seemed to echo from some far-off place, some place where James was not kneeling in the wet and the fog next to a motionless Christopher, whose chest had been scored across by the ragged lines of demon claws. Some place where Christopher was not still and silent, no matter how much James begged him to open his eyes. Some place where Christopher's blood was not mixing with the rain on the cobblestones, surrounding him in a pool of crimson. Some place better than this. Cordelia had been hoping to speak to her brother again,
but she rose so late in the day that by the time Risa had helped her dress and sent her downstairs, Alistair had already gone out. Despite the afternoon sunlight streaming through the windows, the house seemed muffled and dim, the ticking of the clock unnaturally loud as she ate her porridge in the dining room. It tasted like sawdust in her mouth. She kept remembering Alistair's words of the night before. "I wanted you to have a childhood, a thing I never had. I wanted you to be able to love and respect your father as I never could." She realized with a chill of shame that she had badly misunderstood her mother and brother. She had thought they would not stand up for her father because of cowardice and social pressure. Now she realized they knew Elias might have been in the wrong, so drunk that he could not properly consider the safety of those he was sending on a dangerous mission. She had thought her mother wanted her to marry to rid her of the shame of being the daughter of a man on trial in Idris. Now she realized it was far more complicated. No wonder Sonar and Alistair had looked with wariness on her attempts to save her father. They had been afraid she would find out the truth. Her blood felt cold in her veins. They really could lose everything, she thought. She had never quite believed it before. She had always thought justice would prevail. But justice was not as simple as she'd thought. She started when Sonar came into the dining room. Her mother eyed Cordelia consideringly before saying, "Is that one of the dresses James sent you?" Cordelia nodded. She was wearing a deep rose day dress that had been part of the package from Anna. For a moment, Sonar looked wistful. "It is a lovely colour," she said. "The dresses are indeed very beautiful, and probably much better suited to you than the dresses I have given you." "No!" Cordelia rose to her feet, stricken. "Hakbar Sarum!" It was a phrase that literally meant, "I should die," the most extreme form of apology. "I'm an awful daughter. I know you did the best you could." "I know you did, Maman," she thought. "I know you were only trying to protect me." Sonar looked astonished. "By the angel, they are only dresses, Leila," she smiled. "Perhaps you could make it up to me by helping about the house, as a good daughter should." Tricked, as usual, Cordelia thought, but she was more than a little glad to have the distraction. More unpacking had to be done, and there were decisions to be made as to where certain bits of Isfahan pottery might be set, or whether Tabriz rugs could be placed to best advantage. As Cordelia watched her mother bustle about, clearly in her element, she felt the words roll to the tip of her tongue. "Did you know when you married him, Maman? Did you find out one day, or was it a slow realization, a terrible dawning of knowledge? All those times you said he should go to the Basileus, did you think they could cure his drunkenness? Did you weep that he refused to go? Do you still love him?" Sonar stepped back to admire a small collection of framed miniatures by the stairs. "That looks nice there, doesn't it? Or do you think it was better in the other room?" "Definitely better there," Cordelia said, having no idea what other room her mother meant. Sonar turned, a hand braced against the small of her back. "Have you been paying she began, and winced suddenly. She leaned back against the wall as Cordelia hurried over to her, worried. "Are you feeling well? You look tired." Sonar sighed. "I am perfectly all right, Cordelia." She straightened up, her hands hovering as if she couldn't quite decide what she wanted to do with them. It was a gesture she made only when very nervous. "But I am expecting a baby." "What?" Sonar smiled a shaky smile. "You will have a little brother or sister, Leila, in only a few more months." Cordelia wanted to throw her arms around her mother, but was suddenly terrified. Her mother was 42, late for a woman to carry a child. For the first time in her life, her formidable mother looked fragile to her. "How long have you known?"
3 months, Sonar said. "Alistair knows as well. So does your father."
Cordelia swallowed.
But you didn't tell me.
Layla June. Her mother came closer to her. I didn't want to worry you more than you were already worried about our family. I know you have been trying. She broke off, stroking a stray lock of hair back from her daughter's face.
You know you do not have to marry if you do not want to, she said, almost in a whisper. We will get by, darling. We always do.
Cordelia placed a kiss in the palm of her mother's thin hand, marked with many ancient scars from the time long ago when she had fought demons.
Chesme Roshan, Mother June, she whispered.
Her mother's eyes sparkled with tears.
Thank you, darling.
A heavy knock came at the front door. Cordelia exchanged a surprised look with her mother before heading to the entryway. Risa had answered the door, and on the front step stood the grubby newsboy Matthew had given her satchel to outside Garst's flat. One of the irregulars, she recalled, the downworlder boys who worked out of the Devil Tavern and ran errands for James and the others.
Got a message here for Miss Cordelia Carstairs, he said, clinging to a folded piece of paper.
That's me, Cordelia said. Do you, require payment?
Nope, said the boy, grinning cheerfully. Been paid already by Mr. Matthew Fairchild. Here you go.
He handed over the message and scrambled down the steps, whistling. Risa shut the door, sharing a puzzled look with Cordelia.
Why would Matthew send her a note like this? Cordelia wondered, unfolding the paper. What could be so urgent?
The note fell open. There were only a few words on the page, but they stood out in shocking black ink. Come at once to the Devil Tavern. There was an attack. Christopher is badly wounded. James.
Cordelia?
Sonar had come into the entryway.
What's going on?
Her hands shaking, Cordelia handed the note to her mother. Sonar read it quickly before pressing the note back into Cordelia's hand.
You must go and be with your friends.
Relief washed over Cordelia. She started to dash upstairs for her things but paused.
I should wear my gear, she said, but it's still damp from the river.
Sonar smiled at her, a weary, worried smile, the smile of so many Shadow Hunter parents down through the ages who had watched their children march into the night, carrying blades blessed by angels, knowing they might never return.
Layla, my daughter, you can wear mine.
Cordelia raced up the steps inside the Devil Tavern and burst into the Merry Thieves clubrooms. It was quite late in the afternoon now, and sunlight filtered through the east window, laying gold bars of light across the shabby little space and its occupants. Matthew was sprawled on the sofa, Lucy in a ragged armchair. Lucy looked up and smiled when Cordelia came in, but her eyes were red. James alone was standing. He leaned against the wall by the window, the shadows deep under his eyes. All three shadow hunters were in gear.
What happened? Cordelia said, a little breathless. What can I do?
Matthew looked up at her. His voice was hoarse.
We were at my house, using my father's laboratory, he said. The Korra demons, were waiting for us when we left.
We ought to have been prepared, said James. He was opening and closing his right hand, as if he wished to crush something in his palm.
We should have remembered.
We were hurrying for the carriage. They attacked us in front of the house. One of them tore a gash across Christopher's chest.
Christopher.
Cordelia could see his bright smile, his dented spectacles. She could hear his eager and excited voice in her ears, explaining some new aspect of science or shadow hunting.
I am so sorry, she whispered. Is he ill? What can we do?
He was already feverish when they took him to the Silent City, said Matthew grimly. We summoned you and Lucy as soon as we could, and...
There were footsteps on the stairs. The door flew open and Thomas burst in. He wore a long Inverness coat, though Cordelia could see that he was in gear beneath.
Sorry, he said breathlessly. I was patrolling with Anna. Didn't get your message until we returned to Uncle Gabriel's house. They all wanted to go to the Silent City, of course, but Brother Enoch came by. Said it was impossible.
Thomas sank down into a chair, burying his face in his hands. Everyone's frantic. Anna went to ask Magnus for help in putting up extra wards around the house. Aunt Cecily nearly lost her mind at the thought of letting her go, but she went. Uncle Will and Aunt Tessa came, of course, but I couldn't bear to be there too, bothering them all, intruding on them in their fear.
You're not an intrusion, Thomas, said Matthew. You're family, there and here.
The door creaked open and Polly came in, carrying a bottle and a few glasses with chipped rims. She set them down on the table, cast Thomas a worried glance, and disappeared. Matthew rose and took the bottle, pouring out the glasses with the grace of long habit. For the first time in Cordelia's memory, Thomas picked one up and downed the contents. James spun one of the chairs around and sat down, arms crossed across the chair back, his long legs hooked around the front.
Tom, he said, his eyes flaring intently, we need to make the antidote to the Mandacore poison. I think you can do it.
Thomas choked, coughed, and began spluttering as Matthew took the glass from him and set it back down on the table.
I can't, he said when he caught his breath. Not without Christopher.
Yes, you can, said James. You've done everything with him. You've been in the laboratory with him nearly every moment since Barbara died. You know how to do this. Thomas was silent for a long moment. James didn't move. His gaze was fixed on his friend. It was a look Cordelia couldn't describe, a quiet intensity mixed with immovable conviction. This was James at his best, she thought. His faith in his friends was unwavering. It was strength, and they shared that strength between them.
Perhaps, Thomas said at last, slowly, but we're still missing an ingredient. Without it, the antidote won't work, and Kit said it was impossible to find.
Mallus root, said Matthew. We know where it is and where to get it. All we need to do is go to Chiswick House, to the greenhouse.
My grandfather's house, Thomas said incredulously. He ran his fingers distractedly through his light brown hair.
Finally, Benedict Lightwood will be responsible for something useful, Matthew said. If we leave now, we can be there in half an hour.
Wait, said Thomas, rising to his feet. James, I'd nearly forgotten. Neddy gave me this.
He handed over a folded piece of thin vellum paper, with James's name scrawled across the front in a careful hand. James unfolded the note and stood up with a violent swiftness, nearly knocking the chair over.
What is it? Said Cordelia. James?
As he handed her the note, Cordelia saw Matthew's thoughtful gaze flick between the two of them. She glanced down. Come to the Silent City. I shall meet you in the infirmary. Do not reveal yourself to the other brothers. I will explain when you arrive. Please hurry. Jem. She handed it wordlessly to Lucy. James was pacing the floor, hands in his pockets.
If Jem says I must go, then I must, he said, as Matthew and Thomas both glanced at the note's contents. The rest of you go to Chiswick.
No, Matthew said.
He had reached for the flask in his pocket, a gesture of long-practiced habit, but quickly dropped his hand. His fingers were shaking slightly, but his voice was light.
Whither thou goest, I will go, James, even unto the tedious suburb of Highgate.
Jem, Cordelia thought. She had to talk to him about her father. There was no one else she could speak to about what Alistair had told her. There was no one else she could tell that she had changed her mind.
Cousin Jem,
I have something to tell you about my father. I think he needs to be in the Basileus. I think he should not come back from Idris after all. I think I need your help. She took a deep breath. I will also go. I must see Jem, unless... She turned to Lucy. If you'd rather I go with you to Chiswick.
Nonsense, Lucy said, sympathy in her eyes. All we're doing is fetching a plant, and I'm familiar with the house and grounds.
Not, she added hastily as James looked dark, because I've lurked about or spied on that property at all, because of course I haven't. You and Thomas can take my carriage, said Matthew. It is downstairs. And the rest of us can take a hansom cab, said Cordelia. Where is the nearest entrance to the Silent City? In Highgate Cemetery, said James, reaching for his weapons belt, as the others caught up gear jackets, belts and blades. It's a good distance. We'll have to hurry. There's no time to waste. There was little to slow Cordelia and the others down until they reached Highgate, where the narrow streets were snarled up with evening traffic. The driver of the hansom cab, refusing to brave the bottleneck, deposited them in front of a pub on Salisbury Road. James asked Cordelia and Matthew to wait while he went to search for the entrance to the Silent City. It often moved about within the cemetery, he had told Cordelia in the carriage, and could be found in various locations depending on the day. Matthew gave the pub a longing look, but was soon distracted by a large stone tablet at the junction of Highgate Hill and Salisbury Road. It was caged by iron rails and carved with the words, Thrice Lord Mayor of London. Turn again, Whittington, thrice Lord Mayor of London Town, said Matthew with a dramatic gesture. This is where it's meant to have happened. Him hearing the Bow Bells, I mean. Cordelia nodded. She had been told the story often enough when she was a child. Richard Whittington had been a mundane boy who had set out from London with his cat, determined to make his fortune elsewhere, only to hear the bells of St. Mary Le Bow calling him back to a promised glory if he returned. And so he had, and become Mayor of London 3 times. Cordelia wasn't sure what had happened to the cat. All the stories might be true, she thought, but it would be awfully nice if such obvious signals were on offer for her own destiny. Matthew slipped his silver flask from his waistcoat and began to unscrew it. Though he was in gear, he had not sacrificed his blue spats to duty. Cordelia only looked at him as he tipped back his head and swallowed, then screwed the cap back on. Dutch courage, he said. Are the Dutch particularly brave or just particularly drunk? She asked, her voice sharper than she'd intended. A little of both, I imagine. His tone was light, but he put away the flask. Did you know Dick Whittington's cat might never have existed? Scandalous fiction, apparently. Does it matter if he had a cat or not? The truth always matters, Matthew said. Not when it comes to stories, Cordelia said. The point of stories is not that they are objectively true, but that the soul of the story is truer than reality. Those who mock fiction do so because they fear the truth. She felt, rather than saw, Matthew turn to look at her in the dimming light. His voice was hoarse. James is my parabatai, he said, and I love him. The only thing that I have never understood about him is his feelings for Grace Blackthorne. I have wished for a long time for him to place his affection somewhere else, and yet, when I saw him with you in the Whispering Room, I was not happy. Cordelia had not expected such frankness. What do you mean? I suppose I question if he knows what he feels, said Matthew. I suppose I worry that he will hurt you.
He is your parabatai, said Cordelia. Why should you care if he hurts me?
Matthew tipped his head back to look at the darkening evening sky. His lashes were several shades darker than his blonde hair. I don't know, he said, but I find that I do care. Cordelia wished they were discussing anything else. Don't worry. Alistair gave me the same warning about James just yesterday. I have been well told. Matthew's jaw tightened. I always said that the day I would be in charity with Alistair Carstairs would be the day I burn in hell. Was he really so horrible to James at school? Said Cordelia. Matthew turned to her, and the look on his face startled her. It was the purest fury. It was more than that. James appeared out of the shadows, his black hair disarrayed, and beckoned to them. I've found the entrance. We ought to go quickly. They proceeded to the cemetery and passed through the tall gates. Dark cypress trees soared overhead, their overlapping leaves blocking out the last of the evening light. In their shadow rose elaborate monuments to the dead. Great mausoleums and Egyptian obelisks towered beside broken granite columns, symbolizing life cut short. Headstones were carved into hourglasses with wings, Greek urns, and beautiful women with streaming hair. And everywhere, of course, there were stone angels, chubby and sentimental-looking, sweet-faced as children. How little mundanes understood about angels, Cordelia thought, picking her way along the twig-strewn path after James. How much they did not understand what was terrifying about their power. James turned off one of the grey avenues then, and they found themselves in an open space that seemed deep in the woods, leaves clustered so thickly above them that the waning light was tinged with green. In the centre of the clearing was a statue of an angel, but this was no cherub. It was the marble figure of a beautiful man of great height. Scaled armour had been carved on his body. He held a sword in one outstretched hand, etched with the words, Quis ut Deus, and his head was thrown back as if he were crying out to heaven. James stepped forward, raising one hand, the one that bore the Herondale ring with its pattern of birds. Quis ut Deus, he said. Who is like God? The angel asks. The answer is no one. No one is like God. The stone angel's eyes opened. Absolutely black, apertures into a great and silent dark. Then, with a grinding of stone, the angel slid aside, revealing a great empty pit in the earth and stairs leading downward. James lit his witchlight as they proceeded down the stairs into a shadowed darkness. The silent brothers, living as they did with eyes sewn shut, did not see as ordinary shadow hunters did, and did not require light. The shimmering white witchlight rayed out between James's fingers, painting the walls with bars of light. As they reached the bottom of the stairs, James caught Cordelia's arm and swung her around into an archway below the steps. Matthew followed a moment later. James closed his hand over the witchlight, dousing its illumination. The three of them watched in silence as a group of silent brothers, their parchment robes brushing the ground, swept by and vanished through another archway. Jem said not to reveal ourselves to the other brothers, James whispered. The infirmary is on the far side of the speaking stars. We must move quickly and quietly. Cordelia and Matthew nodded. A moment later they were passing through an enormous room full of keyhole-shaped stone archways rising overhead. Semi-precious stones alternated with marble, tiger's eye, jade, malachite. Beneath the arches huddled mausoleums, many with family names etched into them. Ravenscar, Crosskill, Lovelace. They reached a great square whose floor was inlaid with tiles printed in a pattern of shimmering stars. On a wall, high above reach, hung a massive dull silver sword whose crosspiece was carved in the shape of angel wings. The mortal sword. Cordelia's heart skipped a beat. The sword that her father had held, though it had not been able to make him speak a truth he could not remember. They passed through the square and into a large space lined with rough flagstones. A pair of wooden doors led one way, a great square arch led another. The doors sported runes of death and peace and silence. "Get back," Matthew whispered suddenly. He threw an arm out, pressing James and Cordelia back into the shadows. Cordelia remained motionless as a silent brother passed by them and went up a set of nearby stairs. With a nod, James slipped from the shadows, followed by Matthew and Cordelia. They ducked under the square archway and into another massive room with a vaulted stone ceiling, crisscrossed with beams of stone and wood. The walls were bare, and up and down the room marched rows of beds, each with a still figure lying in it. Cordelia guessed there might have been 30 or so sick people there. Young and old, male and female, they lay as soundless and unmoving as if they had already died. The room was utterly silent. Silent and empty. Cordelia bit her lip.
"Where is Jem?"
But Matthew's eyes had lighted on a familiar figure.
"Christopher," he said,
and darted over, followed by James. Cordelia came after them more slowly, reluctant to intrude. Matthew was crouching down beside a narrow iron bed. James stood at the head, leaning over Christopher. Christopher had been stripped of his shirt. Dozens of white bandages encircled his narrow chest. Blood had already soaked through some of them, forming a scarlet patch over his heart. His glasses were gone, and his eyes seemed sunk deep into his skull, the shadows below them dark purple. Black veins unfurled like coral beneath his skin.
"Matthew," he said with hoarse disbelief. "Jamie."
James reached to touch his friend's shoulder, and Christopher caught at his wrist. His fingers were twitching. He picked restlessly at the cuff of James's jacket.
"Tell Thomas," he whispered. "He can finish the antidote without me. He only needs the root. Tell him."
Matthew was silent. He seemed sick with pain. James said,
"Thomas knows. He is with Lucy now, collecting the root. He'll finish it, Kit."
Cordelia cleared her throat, knowing her voice would come out as a whisper regardless. It did.
"Jem," she whispered. "Has Jem been in here, Christopher?"
He smiled at her sweetly.
"James Carstairs," he said. "Jem."
Cordelia looked nervously at James, who gave her an encouraging nod.
"Yes," she said, "James Carstairs, my cousin."
"James," Christopher whispered, and then the figure in the bed next to his echoed the word.
"James," whispered Piers Wentworth. "James."
And then the next figure, in the next bed.
"James."
Matthew rose to his feet. "What's going on?" Christopher's lilac eyes flew wide. His grip on James's wrist tightened as he jerked him forward. Face inches from James's, he hissed,
"Get out of here. You have to get out of here. You have to leave. James, you don't understand. It's about you. It's always been about you."
"What does that mean?" Matthew demanded, as more and more voices were added to the chant.
"James. James. James."
Matthew took hold of James's sleeve and drew him back from Christopher, who let go of James reluctantly. Cordelia put her hand to the hilt of Cortana.
"What's going on?" she demanded. "Christopher?"
One by one, the sick were rising into sitting positions, though it did not look as if they were doing so of their own volition. It seemed they were being dragged upward like puppets on strings. Their heads sagged loosely to the side, their arms limp and dangling. Their eyes were wide open, white and shining in the dimness of the room. Cordelia saw with horror that the whites of them were also veined in black.
"James Herondale."
It was the voice of Ariadne Bridgestock. She sat at the edge of her own narrow bed, her body slumped forward. Her voice rasped, empty of emotion.
"James Herondale, you have been summoned."
"By who?" Matthew shouted. "Who's summoning him?"
The prince, said Ariadne. The lord of thieves. Only he can stop the dying. Only he can call off the Mandacor, the poison bringer. You carry the taint now, Herondale. Your blood can open the gateway. She took a deep, shuddering breath. You have no other choice.
Drawing away from Matthew, James took a step toward her. What gateway?
Ariadne.
Cordelia threw out an arm to stop him.
This is not Ariadne.
What is going on here?
They all turned. It was Jem, who had entered the room in a swirl of parchment robes. He carried his oak staff in his hand. Despite the stillness of his face, Cordelia could sense how furious he was. It radiated from the words that exploded into her mind.
What are you three doing here?
I got your message, said James. You told me to come.
I sent no message, said Jem.
Yes, you did, protested Cordelia indignantly. We all saw it.
Our master sent the message, said Ariadne. He waits in the shadows. Still, he controls all.
Jem shook his head. His hood had fallen back so that Cordelia could see the white streak in his dark hair.
There is foulness at work here, he said.
He lifted the oaken staff in his hands, and Cordelia saw the letters WH carved into the grip. The sick were all chanting James's name now, their voices rising in a hazy murmur. Jem brought the staff down, and the noise of the wood striking the stone floor echoed in their ears. The chanting stopped. The sick went still. Jem turned to Cordelia and the boys.
Some evil has brought you here, Jem said. Get out. I fear you are in danger. They ran.
The flight out of the silent city was almost a blur to Cordelia. James went first, the witchlight in his hand illuminating their path as they darted out of the way of various silent brothers. She and Matthew came after. In seconds, they had all reached the last stairway, where it arced up toward the sky. Suddenly, Matthew gasped. He staggered, falling back against the stone wall as if he'd been pushed. Cordelia caught at his arm.
Matthew, what's happening?
His face was paper white. James, he whispered. There's something very wrong with James. Cordelia glanced up the stairs. James vanished from her view. He must not have realized they were no longer following.
Matthew, he's fine. He's out of the city.
Matthew pushed away from the wall. We must hurry, was all he said, and began to run again. They tore up the stairs and burst out into the clearing above. James was nowhere to be seen. Matthew took Cordelia's hand. He's this way, he said, and drew her through a narrow path between the trees. It was nearly black beneath the canopy of leaves, but Matthew seemed to know exactly where he was going. They emerged in a shadowy grove ringed with tombs, the sky above them the deep blue of late twilight. James was there, standing still as a statue. A statue of a dark prince, all in black, with hair like crow's feathers. He was in the process of casting aside his jacket, puzzlingly, since it had grown cold now that it was evening. He was not looking at Matthew or Cordelia, but at something in the distance. His expression was stark, his eyes ringed with darkness. He looked ill, Cordelia realized with dismay, as if, just as Matthew had said, there was something very wrong. Matthew cupped his hands around his mouth.
James!
James turned slowly, dropping his jacket to the ground. He was moving mechanically, like an automaton. Cordelia's unease mounted. She went toward James, slowly, as if she were approaching a startled deer in the forest. He watched her with restless gold eyes. There was colour in his cheeks, a high, consumptive flush,
She heard Matthew curse under his breath.
James, she said, what's wrong?
He rolled up the left sleeve of his shirt. On the back of his wrist, just above where the cuff of his shirt would have ended, were four small bloody crescents surrounded by a tracery of darkening veins. Nail marks. Christopher, said James, and Cordelia remembered with horror the way Christopher had clutched at James in the sick room, gripping his wrist. I know he didn't mean to. His mouth twisted into a painful smile. No one tell him. He'd be so upset.
Oh, James, no. Please, no.
She thought of Oliver Hayward, dead because Barbara had clawed him in her last agonies.
Not James.
Matthew's voice shook. We have to go back to the Silent City. We have to get you to Jem.
No, Cordelia whispered. It isn't safe for James there. If we went to the Institute, or brought Jem there.
Absolutely not, said James very calmly. I'm not going anywhere. Not anywhere in London, at least. Bloody hell, he's hallucinating, said Matthew with a groan. But Cordelia didn't think he was. In a low voice, she said, James, what do you see? James raised his hand and pointed. There, between those two trees. And he was right. Suddenly, Cordelia, and Matthew as well, could see what James had been staring at all this time. Between two cedar trees was a large archway. It seemed to be made of dark light. It curved with Gothic flourishes, as though it were part of the cemetery, but Cordelia knew it was not. Through it, she could glimpse a swirl of dark chaos, as if she were looking through a portal into the vastness of black space itself. A gateway, said Matthew slowly.
Like Ariadne said, whispered Cordelia. James, your blood...
She shook her head.
Don't do it, whatever it is. Everything about this feels wrong.
But James only turned and went over toward the archway. He stretched out his arm toward it, the one with the wounds where Christopher's nails had punctured his skin, and made a fist. The muscles of his arm swelled, and blood ran from the cuts on his wrist. They looked slight, but fat drops of red rose up along his arm and dripped onto the ground. The view through the archway seemed to solidify and clear itself, and now Cordelia could glimpse the world she'd seen on the bridge, a place with earth and sky like ashes, and trees like protrusions of bone. James, Matthew said, closing the gap between himself and his friend. Stop! I have to do this. James lowered his bleeding arm. His eyes were feverish, whether from determination or the poison now in his veins, Cordelia wasn't sure. Math, you shouldn't touch me. It's not safe. Matthew, who had been reaching for James, stopped abruptly and flung his arms wide.
James! Is that why you're going?
Cordelia demanded. She could taste tears in the back of her throat. She wanted to break something, to take Cortana and smash the blade against the granite sides of the tombs.
Because you think you're going to die? Thomas and Lucy are getting the Malos root right now. We could have an antidote in a day. In hours.
It's not that, James shook his head. Whether I'd been infected or not, I'd have to go, and you would have to let me.
Why?